lose 40 years of my life, and I'm 53 right now, even more. I started soldering when I was 7.5 years old. And I was using that material. Now, you got to understand that this material has to be the amber color and has to be heavy. That means heavy, it's not heavy because of the weight, is like a solid, it's not liquid. Back to you.
Does it have the approximate consistency of a bar of wax, somewhat like the wax of a candle or paraffin that's used for home cooking? Back to you, Wesley.
That is correct. The only thing is that it's more solid, and when you knock it with something, it cracks. It doesn't chip, it cracks. I mean, it creates a... It's not like you knock with the hammer the wax. It's splashed. It's cracked. Back to you. Oh, another thing. It smells beautiful. When you heat it up, you enjoy the smell. Back to you.
Okay, so it's got a pleasant smell, and let's hope that that's not toxic. Very good. So, the Californium in solid form, used for rubbing on bowstrings or on the horsehair bow of a violin, and probably also some of these other stringed instruments. When Mel and I cut our teeth on Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you should pay a little more attention when you hear that, even though it's way down. Somebody from Echolink is trying to break in. Just give them an opportunity.
The only one I've heard tonight is K2YO and also WS2H. Is either one of those trying to break in?
Yes, affirmative, Dick.
That sounded like Bernie. Go right ahead, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick and Nanette. I just want to make a comment. I've been trying to break in, but it's been a lively conversation tonight, which is good. If you go to YouTube, there are a number of good videos on basic soldering. Some of the things are very visually based. You know, when you get the joint hot and well flux, that moment when the solder flows, those are captured very well on the videos on YouTube. So when the people get their iron and they're working on old feed-through kind of stuff, there's some really good videos to check out there. KTYO.
Good information, Bernie. Bernie, when I go to YouTube and I do a search, just should I use the word soldering or soldering instruction? Do you have a particular set of search words that you think would help us find the YouTube video that would be most helpful? Over to you, Bernie.
I just started with how to solder, and that got me some. I also tried how to solder surface mount, how to desolder surface mount. Any of those will run across some soldering for like plumbing pipes or stuff about how to solder wires to speakers, and also soldering for jewelry, like silver soldering, that kind of stuff. But if you poke them, once you get in and just say how to solder, hit one that looks like they're doing component soldering, and then that'll lead to more links, to more links, to more links.
Sounds like very good information, and I thank you. So, yeah, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I guess a million pictures, a moving picture is worth, a video is worth, an animation is worth 1,000,000 words. So, by way of YouTube and how to solder, how to desolder, how to do surface mount soldering, these search words should help an awful lot. Watch that, and it'll hopefully give you some examples of doing the correct procedure or the incorrect procedure. There's 10 ways of doing it incorrectly and a relatively small ways of doing it correctly, and it is an art form. There is a learning curve. Very few people start off doing excellent solder joints on the first 10 attempts, so to speak. It's something you've got to do a number of times, learning how to properly clean the materials, how to properly use the materials in order to do a good solder joint. A good solder joint, done correctly, will hold a circuit together as long as you've got the right auxiliary mechanical supports. That circuit will hold together even though that circuit is dropped on the floor and experiences 500 or 2,000 G's of shock. A good solder joint will do that. A cold solder joint will fall apart very rapidly, and sometimes sometimes make intermittent contact, which can drive you up a wall when it comes to troubleshooting a particular circuit. Let me drop.
Dick, why don't you go Wikipedia, check in Wikipedia, California, or in Polish, California. You're going to get it. It's and it says everything.
Another very good suggestion. So by way of Wikipedia and a Google search on California or California, maybe with the plus soldering flux or plus rosin for a bowstring or a violin bow, by some combination of the search words, we're going to find some more information on this material. But one other thing I was going to mention, please put in an arm for you, please. Somebody said something very fast. You're going to have to slow down and try one more time. And if you're giving me your call letters, give me your call letters and your name. And if it's a comment on this particular subject, please proceed. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, C-N-A-R. His name here is Gabe. I also mentioned to avoid the cold spotter joint, always use Eutectic 6337 solder. If you happen to move while you're soldering, it goes from a liquid to a solid without any plastic staying in between. You might want to explain that to the person on the
Very fine, Gabe. So Gabe is recommending that if you have the choice, try to buy what's called eutectic solder. That means the lead-tin combination is 6337. That's the solder that has the lowest possible melting temperature with no plastic region, whereas the more popular solder, 60-40 ratio of lead and tin, does have a softening set of temperatures. In other words, as you watch a hot fluid joint of 60-40 solder slowly cool off, it goes from purely liquid to sort of a paste-like appearance, and then it becomes hard, whereas the eutectic solder 3763, it goes directly from the liquid state to the solid state with no intermediate effect. Now, this intermediate plastic effect is not bad if and only if you are not moving the soldered circuits at that time. When 6040 solder is in that plastic state, at that magic temperature where it is halfway between solid and liquid, if you move the wire that's into the PC board at that time, so to speak, you could end up with a broken joint or a cold joint. So I'm not against 6040, as long as you're smart enough not to move it as it cools. One other thing I was going to mention, and that is with reference to meters. When Mel and I first learned electronics, the most popular volt meter was made by Triplett or Simpson. One of them had model number of 630, and I forget what the other model number was, but the Simpson company and the Triplett company made a volt ohm milliammeter, which sat about 10 inches high and about 6 inches wide and about... what was that again?
They still make it. It's Simpson 260.
Okay, Simpson 260, and what was the triplet model that was so popular, Eric?
It was a 277, and it was a 377. I had that big, big knob in the center.
No, 630 was the triplet, and 260 was the Simpson.
Okay, so Simpson and triplet, very, very popular volt-ohm milliammeters. Great big knob in the center where you could select which voltage scale, which ohm meter scale, AC or DC, and a great big Dawson valve meter movement. Some of them had mirror scales. Very, very popular in its day as an analog meter. It's very tempting to use one of those. They're quite rugged, quite popular in the old days. Nowadays, they're not quite as popular for two or three reasons. Number one, they're kind of big and heavy. Number two, we like digital multimeters these days because a 2.5, a 3.5, or a 4.5 digit meter, and some of those are handheld, nicely made things with true RMS scales, give you a little bit more accuracy, a a NiCad battery being charged, and you want to catch that point where, as it's being charged, the voltage is no longer rising and it starts decreasing in voltage during the charge process, you know that now the cells are probably up to full charge, they're starting to overheat, and you want to slow down the charging at that particular point. To find that peak voltage point with a digital multimeter, having enough digits, is easy. With an old-fashioned analog meter, that's more difficult. Second of all, the modern digital multimeters, almost all of them, have an input impedance of 10 million ohms. It's a very light loading of a circuit, whereas the old-fashioned triplet and Simpson meters, most of those were 20,000 ohms per volt. That's a fancy way of saying the meter itself was a 50 microampere meter movement. So each has its advantages and disadvantages. If you are doing a peaking and nulling operation on the current or voltage on a circuit, to look at an analog meter and watch the needle move up and down is a very simple operation. Let me drop.
Most good digital meters all have an analog indicator.
What Eric is telling us is that the digital meters, when you're looking at pure digits and you try to find the peak or the valley, it takes a lot of mental gymnastics to look at just the numbers and figure that out. The more expensive digital multimeters will display numbers and a bar chart simultaneously. I've never owned one of those. I think they're a little more on the expensive side. For a guy who uses very expensive broadcast quality test equipment like Eric, I'm guessing almost every one of his digital multimeters also has a bar chart. But how many people outside of the broadcast industry are using digital multimeters that also have an analog simultaneous display? Chris, I pass that back to you as a little bit of a challenge, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if you buy a Fluke or you buy a Tektronix, you need a bar chart with it. Although I'm a glutton for punishment when I'm dealing with capacitors and that kind of stuff and I'm troubleshooting, I always keep an analog meter. Even testing transistors, it's just, you know, I don't need absolute values. I just want to watch the meter move. It, you know, it does something for me. It's easier to interpret. But the reality is that, you know, it is a 20,000 ohm per volt meter, so, but, you know, I don't measure voltages with it. I do other things with it. But, yeah, most good digital meters from Fluke or Tektronix or... I've never seen a Hewlett Packard, actually, to come to think of it, but they all have the bar charts. There's a real saving grace with that. There's something intuitive about it. You don't really have to explain, because once you see it, you kind of get it, so to speak. Could you imagine dipping your finals with a digital meter? That's going to be a little bit of a tough one. But you can get used to it just like anything else. And oh, by the way, Dick, if you hear Echolink announced, the only time it will announce is when somebody wants to say something. We turned it off so that way when they log in, you don't hear it. When they log out, you don't hear it. K2IW, K2J.
K2EY.
Okay, very good to know. So when I hear an announcement of a set of call letters, it's because a person wants to make a statement. It isn't because he's signing in. Mel recognized, but on the input, I heard Mr. EAV, Ed Gellander, but I didn't hear him coming through the machine. So either he's out of range or his PL is not turned on. Let me pick up Mel first and then Ed in that order. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, listen, I promise that next week we lost our audience a long time ago, young people, and I promise that this is the way we were going to do it, that we're going to do it every step by step, so we're going to discuss instruments, the basic instruments, next week, and we'll bring up, that's why I'm saying, we'll repeat this again, because I said to them that, you know, we're going to do this step by step, so hopefully, no reason, you know, to do, again, a whole thing on instruments, but I'd like to leave that basically for next week.
Okay, so Bell is recommending we don't go too deep into instrumentation. I'm willing to repeat it next week because the number of people within the sound of my voice who really understand their very basic measurement instruments, a voltmeter, digital multimeter, voltohm-milliammeter, and oscilloscope, some of the most basic instruments, the number of people who really understand them and use them correctly and don't misuse them, is not as big a ratio as I would like. There's a significant learning curve there, and maybe going through that area twice is worthwhile. Let's see what Ed has got to say. Hearing Ed on the input, he might not be coming through the machine tonight. I'm not sure why, but I'll repeat what he says. WB2EAV, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Ed.
Okay.
I'm not sure I do. Am I making it through the repeater now?
Right now you're making it. Check in, we'll pick up with you in a second. Ed first, go ahead. You're making it now.
What I just wanted to say is, if you're looking to get a measurement of a non-human voltage, there's not a digital voltage. If there's any movement whatsoever, leave the digital on the shelf. Analog voltmeter. And I have found very well with really voltmeter. I have on the job when I own a $10 in the toolbox. Because along the adage of in the land of the blind king, even the 10 meter is a million times better than using your fingers and see if you get thrown across the room.
Okay, Ed, I'm listening to you on the input, and I'm beginning to think that your particular rubber duck on that handy talkie that you're using is broken. I'm hearing the amplitude jump up and down with extreme sharpness. If I was looking at it with an oscilloscope, the leading edge and trailing edge of the amplitude change as you walk with that handy talkie is significant, and some of the words were not coming through the machine. So that particular rubber ducky, I'm guessing, or the BNC connector itself, maybe the female prongs have been spread, but it's making an intermittent contact, I can tell, and you might want to know about that. So Ed is telling us is that an analog meter has got an awful lot to say for it when it comes to doing a peaking or knelling operation. I do remember the very first time I owned a digital watch. I had trouble getting used to it, and I wore two watches on the same arm at the same time, a digital watch and an analog watch. I did that for a couple of months. Some people laughed at me. Eventually, you get used to digital numbers, but I used to know what time it was to know that the big hand was up and the little hand was to the right, and I knew that meant 3 o'clock. And to interpret that 3.01 or 2.9, 2.59 meant the same thing. It took a little getting used to. We've all forgotten about that period that we went through. Well, as a new person learning to use a digital multimeter, there is a learning curve. And it's kind of unfortunate from my point of view that only the more expensive ones have also got a simultaneous analog display. A person who wanted to check in, who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, thank you. This is W2TJT, Tango Julia Tango. Name is Tom, and I just have a quick question about where to get a certain component on the amplifier that I'm rebuilding. So if you get a chance, I'll be standing by. That's W2TJT. Name is Tom in Brooklyn.
Okay, nice strong signal there, Tom in Brooklyn. What's the model number on the component that you're looking to locate, and what kind of an amplifier is it? Back to you, Tom.
Mel would be pretty informative on this. It's Collins 3001, and I'm rebuilding the amp itself. I just changed the power supply board to a more modern one, an upgrade, and there's a one capacitor that I'm looking for. It's a 10 UF 250 volts DC capacitor.
Okay, On the input, I heard W2UPP, but not coming through the machine. And let's first turn it to Mel, and then I'll go to UPP in that order. Mel, so on that Collins 30L1, 10 microfarad, 250 volt, I'll bet you there's a zillion substitutes for that, although in order to really fit in the exact same socket, the way it was attached to the chassis, so that everything looks pretty, there's probably a whole process for getting that exact capacitor. K2, K-E-Y, K2-R-I-W, go ahead, Mel.
Now, the original one was a pigtail type, you know, capacitor. Whether you can find one like that or not anymore, that's the question, because, you know, they went through more modern type capacitors. DigiKey and Moser Electronics have capacitors into that voltage range and modern type versions of it. I don't know if they have the pigtail, but the most I have. Maybe to have axially tight, yes, possible, but not a very popular type of, you know, device, Dick. So the best one to check with is, you're not going to get the original column. Forget about that. It's out there. If you found any, they're dried out for sure. DigiKey or Moza, I think, may have it, or even Surplus of Nebraska. Yeah, but I can say, with old stock, it's not going to be much good, Dick. Over.
Eric, you were super weak, but I heard you on the input, and you said if you don't find it in Mauser, you will find it in blank. What was that again, Eric? Go ahead.
Newark.
Okay, so Newark Electronics might have it. That's another a good lead. I heard something that sounded like Whiskey 2, Uniform, Papa, Papa, but that's not the real call letters. Start off with those call letters, your name, and your comment, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, he's not there. As I see it, that capacitor could be a little bit troublesome, Tom, to get the exact same model number. If it's a axial lead capacitor mounted below the chassis, there's lots and lots of substitutes. If it's one of the capacitors that get mounted on the chassis and screwed down, finding the exact one is going to be troublesome. Also, worry about the fact that in the old days, these dry electrolytic capacitors, if they don't have a super good seal on them, they dry out and the number of microfarads goes to zero real fast, and you get a lot of hum out of that power supply. Modern day capacitors, very few capacitors go as high as 250 volts on solid state circuits. Therefore, what you're looking for is becoming more rare. A quality capacitor for that application would be oil fills, but they always require chassis mounting, very rarely, and they've always got leads coming out one end of the can, not actual leads. So I think with the major electronic manufacturing catalogs, like Newark and others, I think you will find those still do exist. Back to you, Tom. W2, Tango, Julia, Tango, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Who has them?
Go ahead, Mel. You found somebody that's got them? Go ahead.
Radio days. They got a whole bunch of capacitors. They said they got a lot of the old capacitors for radios, you know, the 5030 series, 150, all that type of series, Dick. So they said they got some of them that are still good in stock. So you can check with RADIO DA Zulu Echo, DAZE.
Hey, Mel.
Okay, sounds like new old stock. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, Mel, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Nice to hear you.
You're nice to hear you guys, as usual. Doing a great job. No, I'm not looking for nothing fancy. I don't want the original piece. It's a messy mount, so it's floating, so it's no big deal. I changed the power supply board on this thing. I took out the two old boards, and the big old capacitors that I replaced are oily. So my question was, what was that fluid coming out? And I guess Dick answered my question when he said oil fill
oil should be leaking out of that. What do you think, Mel?
Well, he most likely sees some of that electrolyte, that may be. I don't think it's oil. The axial lead, now I know which capacity he's talking about. It does not have oil in it.
It's the one under the chassis, but I mean, there's about six or eight big capacitors on the power supply board that I pulled out, and those are the ones that feel pretty greasy and oily, so that's what I was wondering. But hey, guys, you were. Question, I appreciate it. W2TJT.
Check the axial lead. I'm looking in Radio Day's catalog right now. They have 10 microfarad 450. Axial type. The new seal type, but the axial. So if you get the capacitors reasonably priced, let's see, in packages, single packages, they are $2 a piece.
That's good enough. I only need the one for the low voltage side of the power supply. So, but I bought the kit from W6BN, the power supply board, and I built it, put it together. It came out real nice, and everything's looking up over here. So hopefully I'll have this thing done soon. All right, guys. Thank you. W2TJT. Always a pleasure.
Good luck with that project, Tom, and let us know how it turns out. Mel, with all of the Collins equipment you've ever worked on or repaired or troubleshot, I'm not sure that in the ideal world you should see any oil leaking out of any of the components in the power supply. And if you do, I think that's something to be concerned about from two points of view. Either there is something leaking that shouldn't be leaking, and second of all, I wonder if the oil contains any toxic substances. I know that some of the transformer oil that used to be used was considered toxic. You might have an opinion on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
The term you're groping, polychlorinated by sun.
Okay, PCP, Eric is bringing to our attention. So are there any PCPs in any of those capacitors? And leaking oil in a power supply doesn't sound good to me. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, now you won't have any of that situation in the 30L1 linear. They did not use any capacitors that were oil-filled. The oil-filled capacitors in some of the other rigs, I happen to have a big Collins rig here called the KWS1, and those filter capacitors no doubt contain the old PVC, you know, type of oil. They're oil-filled, regular oil-filled steel can, you know, capacitors, big cans. And the transformers, some of the transformers, like you say, had transformer oil in it that was contained PVC type of fluid. But you won't find that in the that amplifier. The 30L1 is a tabletop amplifier of 4 811s in it. So no problem like that exists in that particular amplifier. What he's seeing is most likely the wax. They were wax capacitors, if you remember. The axial lead ones were wax type. And yeah, there's a modification kit they came up with, but the service actually everything myself, so let me let it drop. I've run into, you know, in some of the other equipment, surplus equipment, I've run into that situation, and if I get any one of those bigger capacitors or the transformers that began to leak, what I did was you take them to the Con Ed, one of the Con Ed buildings, and they will dispose of it properly for you if you want to get rid of that. I've emptied the oil out of a couple of cases, you know, where the transformers were in. Embedded in that oil, the transformer oil. Yeah, I emptied it out, put it into a jar or a container and took it over and left it with them, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think around Long Island there are a number of places that will take toxic waste and properly dispose of it. When it comes to something like a popular, in those days, 30L1 and similar pieces of Collins equipment, I'll bet you have come up with a couple of qualification test procedures, like when it's under load, you will put an oscilloscope or an AC voltmeter on a particular place in the power supply, and depending on the level of the ripple, you can then, the amount of regulation, but mostly level of ripple, how much AC voltage is present on a filter network of a power supply, you can make a judgment as to whether or not the capacitors are up to their required value and everything is working correctly. I wonder if you've come up with a test procedure like that that you use, Mel, when you're servicing an older piece of equipment and you want to bring it up to modern standards in performance. K2KEY, K2RIW in the second half.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, first of all, I have done a lot of two-tone tests, basically, on most of the amplifiers. And most of the amplifiers, believe it or not, the old Collins amplifiers stand up. I shouldn't say that. Most likely one of them is going to blow up on me. But I've got 9 Collins rigs here. And considering the number of years old and the number of hours of use, you know, I'm quite amazed that I have done comparatively very little service on it. Now, just saying the KWS-1, that Collins rig that I have, the transmitter, is a 1957 transmitter. And only about 6 months ago, I had the first real serious problem on it, and that was the relay in there. Boy, if you've ever seen a relay buried, a thing with a lot of contact, but buried. It took me days to literally get that relay out to disconnect so much stuff and all and to replace it. That was the only major repair I ever did on that rig. This rig belonged to a guy that had piled up, I don't know, maybe 100 logs. He was on the air almost constantly under that drop. And the only thing that I did when I got the rig is I did put some tubes in, just replaced some tubes. I was amazed that most of the tubes, everything were in good shape. The only thing is the finals. The finals, I didn't like the design of the final amplifier. They used the 4CX250s in there, Dick. And I took them out and replaced them with 3CX800s. That was the only major change I made in that rig from 1957 over.
A 4CX250B ceramic external anode tube, 250 watts plate dissipation, 2,000 volts on the plate. One of my favorite tubes, Mel. Good up to 500 megacycles. Lots of gain, reasonable linearity, but a real high power tetrode. What made you lose faith in that particular tube, Mel? Did you end up with some gassy ones? Because some of those tubes keep cranking for a large number of years if they're not abused. As long as they're kept sufficiently cool with airflow and not overdriven and not as long as you've got the right kind of protection network, monitoring screen, grid current, those tubes are awfully rugged. What made you lose the faith in that particular tube, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
No, I didn't lose faith in them because I still got a couple of amplifiers with them around. I used them in a mobile, very successful kilowatt in a mobile. The iMac came up with the 3CX800, and what they did is they offered a deal to him that if you buy one with the chimney and the socket, they would give you a second one at half price. And I built an amplifier with a pair of them, and boy, it delivered a good sock of power at that time. You know, you could go that time to 2,000 PEP. And that thing, those tubes really just would go way up there. So I got sort of involved with them, and I decided why. I say, gee, this would make it some improvement on the KWS-1. It was a massive effort. I took out that whole section out of the rig, and I'm telling you, in that rig, it was a massive effort to build a whole new grid box in there. And was it worth the effort? Typically, I would say no. The cost was immense. At that time, it was the cost was about $750-$800 just for the tubes and the sockets. Let me drop it. Now, of course, there's a number of amplifiers that are on the market that you see that are being sold. And the ones that are using final amplifier tubes, of course, they got the ones that are using like 3-500. And then they have the ones that are using the 4CX or the 4X. No, 3CX 1200 or 4CX 1200 series. I don't know. There's some foreign-made ones. And then you see the ones that are using the 4CX 800. So they're still very popular tubes, but the amplifier costs, boy, they're sky-high in the thousands now, Dick, over.
The original 4CX 250B is a rather high-gain tetrode tube. And most people will drive a tetrode tube in grounded cathode grid-driven service. And a 4CX 250B running linear service, full power output, my guess is 1 or 2 watts of drive to the control grid is plenty. The good news about a 3CX 800A7 that you switched over to has got 800 watts of dissipation instead of 250. And when it's driven in grounded grid, cathode-driven service, it has higher linearity, better intermod distortion. Let me drop. But there's a catch. The 3CX 800A7, grounded grid, cathode-driven service, I am guessing requires something like 50 watts of drive to get full power output. Whereas the old 4CX 250B in grid drive required 1 or 2 watts. So the combination of a lot of mechanical modification for the bigger socket for the 3CX 800 and a brand new control grid or cathode drive circuit supplying 50 watts of power instead of 2 watts, that's a lot of change. Without a doubt, you end up with a superior rig, higher peak power output, and greater linearity. But my guess is that kept you busy for a long time. Now, the numbers I just gave you are guesses on my part. I wonder if I'm in the ballpark on any of those, Mel. K2KEY, sounds like an extensive modification. K2RIW in the tech nest.
Say the least, this is K2KEY, major modification. You got to change the filaments also. It's not a 6.3, it's 12-volt filament. And the socket assembly, everything, I mean, that was a major dismantling job of the radio. And I ruined the radio. Basically, that's the bottom line. Works perfect. Works terrific. I had it on the air Friday night. I get on 75 meters with it, with my friends. And boy, all I do is get compliments always from people who check in. That radio, that rig, whatever it is, sounds best on the air. I did a lot of work on the audio system of that. Remember, it's a self-contained transmitter. It's an exciter and amplifier. It's a kilowatt-only rig. In other words, that's it. It runs only, it's completely self-contained exciter and amplifier, all one box, Dick, with a power supply that's under it that weighs 200 pounds. You never seen a power, this thing's power supply is a big box, Dick, that I could say weighs 200 pounds. So let me let it drop. From the standpoint of the original radio, yeah, the front panel looks the same. I didn't drill no holes or anything of that such. But the internal changes that I made have killed the moth, the worst of the thing as an antique, Dick, over.
So if a person wants a vintage KWS1, after you've done this modification, it's no longer vintage, it's no longer virgin or prime. However, if this modification you made was a well-respected modification, and maybe there was a recommended procedure for it printed by IMAC, I still think that that rig could have a lot of resale value. Unfortunately, you probably don't want to resell it. you're happy with it, you're getting all these compliments, but it sounds to me like only a very enthusiastic person with a fair amount of experience should do that modification. Out of curiosity, what did the final rig use as an intermediate drive stage to produce enough, something like 50 watts of drive for that cathode drive service? Was the 4CX250B used as an intermediate driver? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Believe it or not, I had no problem driving it with the original pair of 6CL6s. That is was the drive that drove the 4X250. And I thought that it wouldn't make it, but uses full 1500 watts DC, no problem with a pair of 6CL6s. So I left that intact. But this is not sanctioned. What I did was not sanctioned by the Collins Collective. When I talk to people and they say, oh, the KWS-1, and, you know, they start to discuss it, and then I start bringing up what I did, they say, what in the mind, what got into your mind to do that to that rig? That is sacrilegious, Dick, over.
In the case of a 4CX250B, I think 2,000 volts of B-plus supply to the plate is the maximum recommended. I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess that the 3CX800A7 might run a higher plate voltage in full power output. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
I got the plate voltage up. Yes, I did raise the plate voltage on it. Transformer in there and all is capable of handling it. The transformer in there is rated at the way they were running it. They were running it around 2,000 at approximately it was rated at 1.6 amps, the transformer. The transformer in there weighs 90 pounds by itself. So I changed over the power supply too. I raised the power supply voltage up. So I'm a little high on the power supply. The rig, I can say it'll go 2,000 without sweat, as they say, over.
What is the recommended maximum voltage for a 3CX800A7? Now, Mel, go ahead.
I'm trying to remember what the heck they said was the maximum on it. You know, I can't remember offhand. I don't remember the specifications on the tube. I got it all in the file, definitely, but I think it goes 3,000, I think, without any problems.
That would have been my guess. So you up the power supply in voltage, maybe current, put in a new power transformer, probably beefier rectifiers, new filter capacitors, raise the voltage from 2,000 to 3,000, rework the socket for the bigger tube, probably made other mechanical modifications. Wow, that is enthusiastic. there's a pure Collins, an aficionado may not appreciate that, but a guy who wants a really potent, clean sounding rig, he's still going to like what you've done. And so that's going pretty far. But by the same token, the guys who I pals around with, they brag about their 24 gigahertz rig, their 47 gigahertz rig, and their 120 gigahertz rigs, all homebrew, how much power output they're getting, how linear is their single sideband, how much gain they're getting out of the antenna, what kind of DX contacts they're getting, and so on. So it's a hobby that's extremely educational. Let me drop.
The specs on the tube in front of me.
Hey, I'll pick up those specs in a minute. There's at least 25 different kinds of ham radio, and you can really lose yourself in any one of them if you desire it. And it's a very educational process, and it is really forensic engineering, as I was mentioning earlier. We amateurs get on the air for the most part. We talk to each other. We say, I did such and such. It works better. Maybe you want to do that also. And I think this is the way it works, and this is the reason why I think it works better. And I tried this experiment, That one worked. I tried the other experiment. That one didn't work. I haven't figured out why yet. And somebody says, well, maybe you didn't do the so-and-so process. So by passing information back and forth, we amateurs are primarily communicators. Secondarily, we're tinkerers and experimenters and scientists of a form. And the one thing that I've got against Moonbound Ham Radio is that unless you're one of the big guns, it is not a rag chewer's mode. I mean, we're doing the ultimate in rag chewing here. We get together every Sunday night for the last zillion years. We talk to each other for 4 solid hours. Boy, do we rag chew. But a lot of information gets passed. 89 or 93% of it's damn good information. Some of it's redundant. A little bit of it's got some error. But eventually somebody points out the error, and we correct it. But we amateurs are communicators. But you got to choose a mode, in my opinion, where you do communicating or you're going to be depressed. So what kind of voltages can that tube and powers can that tube take, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. This, let's see, typical operation of the tube between 2,200 volts on a plate. Well, they give an example. If you run 2,200 volts on a plate, the zero single plate current of 65 mils. This is per single tube, of course. It requires a driving power of 18.5 watts. Will produce 707 watts. In other words, gain will be, figure this out, how much gain would you get? They don't give it, they give it a blind care gain. I would say around 16 dB gain because it's 65% efficiency. So look for something like that. So a 2200, 500 mils will yield 707 watts with 18.5 watts of drive. Dick, over.
Okay, I'm looking at, you just said 702 watts output, and I think you said 22 watts of drive. Is that true?
18.5 watts of drive. 707 watts output. 500 mils single tone. At a plate voltage of 2200 volts. And that's, could yield your gain somewhere, I think around, I think if I'm not mistaken, it was around 16 dB, over.
702 watts output, 18.5 watt drive is 15.79, 15.8, let's call it, of dBs of gain. Not bad. In corresponding service, a 4CX250B is going to produce 3 or 4 dB more gain. Only 1 or 2 watts of drive are required, a little bit less power output. Did you run a pair or a single tube 3CX800A7? Go ahead.
The pair. It's two of them in the rig thing. So, pair produced easily 1,500 watts. I'm running a higher plate voltage, closer to 3,000, and I can go quite high in a current. I mean, I got plenty of spare current that seems to go. I have loaded it. I wanted to see. I pushed it one time to its extreme, into a dummy load, of course. And I was, I cleared close to 2,600 watts, I believe, over.
That's a very nice key down power. And boy, can that heat up a dummy load in a hurry with real RF. And I'm not sure. My guess is you get a little bit of heat out of a piece of RG8 cable that feeds that dummy load when you're running that kind of power key down. If 18.5 watts of drive is required per tube and you've got two tubes in parallel, that implies 37 watts of drive is required. And those two driver tubes, I think that's a little bit beyond their capability. But you're not driving each one of them to, let's see, if each tube can produce 700 watts, oh yeah, that would be 1,400. You're getting 2,200. You're coming up to full drive power. I'm amazed that those driver tubes are doing it. Those are pretty healthy tubes you've got there. There's no gas in those. Did you raise the voltage at all on the driver tubes to do that, Mel? Go ahead.
think that they're running hot. Now, I was amazed that, I guess, the air running across them. Everything, you know, I could add a fan. The original, the final amplifiers, has got a quite a hefty fan in the KWS-1 to begin with. That's how they were able to get those 4X250s to run in that box. Really cool. They got a ducted system. Very clever how they did it. They got an air sucking thing in the bottom on the power supply. It's a squirrel cage, big squirrel cage blower. And what they do, that's where the air is sucked through the power supply to cool the power supply. It's then ducted with a pipe with a rubber boot that's about 3 inch diameter. Grid box in through this, so, you know, sucks it up then through the, pushes it up through there through a, like a ductwork, and I had to add in there, I put in, at the output of the ductwork, I added a muffin fan, a 4-inch muffin fan to suck the heat out faster out of that system, Dick, over.
Sounds like a nice, cool rig. And my guess is on that service, the way you normally run those 3CX887s, they're essentially idling. As long as they don't suddenly develop gas, they're going to last forever. So that rig will be in your possession for a long time to come. Sounds like a pleasure to use. I presume you have the ability to use that on 80 through 10 meters inclusive. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
You can use it on 80 through 10. In fact, what is nice about that rig, it is designed with, I guess you could even put in some of the Walkmans if you want to do some re-engineering in it further, but it's got a rotary inductor in there. It's not fixed tap final coil in there. It's got a good heavy duty, you should see this thing, rotary inductor, and it's silver plated wire, and oh, a very fancy piece of equipment, Dick. If you look into it, you say, ah, this was a rig, you know. You can tell when Collins built that, because it was built, you know, it also operates AM, and when Collins built that, they didn't build it for amateur radio. In fact, it wasn't really... Very few of them really got into amateur radio hands. The maximum production on it went to about a little over, I think, 2,500 rigs. Only out of, less than 1,000 wound up at ham, with ham radio operators. The rest went to the military because the cost of it was astronomical for the time, over.
When you run that rig in the AM mode, and a few of the guys in 80 meters love to doing that, my guess is you can run carrier power of 650 watts, and you've got pure linear double sideband plus carrier AM. Is that approximately true, Mel? Go ahead.
Got an elaborate system in there, Dick. You know, they got mechanical filters in there, and they got one for AM in there, and one for sideband, and one for CW. And let me tell you something, they've got, you have no idea what a piece of machinery this is. Mechanically and electronically, this was state of the art when it was built in 1950. And you just got to look at it before you can appreciate it. We could spend the whole night here just talking about this piece of equipment and never do it justice. You know, it's got a built-in VFO in it and all. One of the scroll types that's got that PTO system, and which was big on Collins, and of course I have the twin receiver to it, which was the Collins 75A4 receiver. So I made it up. I changed it originally, you know, with a receiver transmitter, but I changed it into a transceiver system that I could go transceive also. That was a another major job. So what I did there and all, a couple of Collins guys looked at it and they just stood there with their mouth open, shook their heads and said, I don't know if it, what you did should go into the books, over.
It sounds like you really brought it up to date at that particular time. I should know, what was the town and state where the main Collins company was located?
Cedar Rapids.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And when you look at the Bill Orr VHF handbook, you see a nice article about some of the meteor scatter experiments they were doing from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Not Fort Collins, Colorado, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Would have been interesting if they had located in Fort Collins. And I presume the company was formed by Mr. Collins himself. Any idea roughly when he became a Silent Key? What was his call letters?
Hey, Arthur Collins. Yeah. He would call letters. I have his cue. I felt like I spoke to him. Oh, my God. It's not something I can't remember his call letters. Ooh, this is embarrassing. I'm getting old, Dick. And he started the company back in the 30s, believe it or not. And he was a real stickler for perfection. I mean, this guy was not only a brilliant engineer, you know, he really made single sideband the choice of radio communication. I got his history about, you know, all the things that he accomplished. And it's amazing, just amazing, you know, what they were doing at that time. It was really cutting edge. It was the cutting edge of radio communication. Oh, my God, why can't I think it's going to drive me crazy? I'll have to go look it up. Arthur Collins, W5, Iowa, 7-something, I think. I'm not sure. I don't remember. And that's something. But it was the last word in equipment, but, of course, price-wise, that's why it was very hard, very one-tenth of the, I don't know what percentage of the ham population was able to afford it at the time. A handful, over.
W0CXX. Wonder if that rings a bell. W0CXX. Art Collins. The good old days. Out of curiosity, Mel, what is the highest frequency you've ever used on ham radio from your QTH or anywhere else? Over to you, Mel.
I fooled around with everything, right up to 10 gigs. You know, I still got the 10 gig set up laying in the garage. And, in fact, you know something? You bring up a very interesting thing. I found a picture. Where was that picture? Do you remember that picture I found? I got a picture taken, and I think it's with you. Believe it or not, it must be guy with you. That I'm standing behind this antenna, this parabolic, and I can see in the reflect. You know, I can back. It has a K2RIW on it. It looks like. And I'm standing in the back of it where you were shaking hands with a whole bunch of people, and I don't know, I found them. I got to miss that picture. You don't know. I'm asking why, but I don't know where it went to. A very unusual picture, Dick. I think we met many years ago, over.
Yeah, at the East Coast VHF Society antenna gain competitions beginning in 1969, I think it was, 68-69. I had that stressed parabolic dish antenna where on the aluminum screening I wrote my call letters. Sometimes I would be standing on a picnic table while aiming that during a competition. So I guess you're saying you and I met at that time, and little did we know, we would get together again years later. Only 4 hours per night every week for years and years on end. Crazy people. So that was probably in Saddlebrook Park, New Jersey. And in that picture, was the antenna laying on the table, or was it being held on a picnic table? I usually would assemble it on a picnic table. What do you remember about that picture? And by the way, a similar picture is on the front cover of QST Magazine, August 1972. Now back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. It was 1972. Isn't that something? You remembered it. Yep. It was 1972.